From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russia engaged in an unprecedented attack against our democracy when it interfered in our 2016 elections.
Left unchecked, Russia is sure to continue its aggression.
Russia engaged in a blatant effort to meddle in our domestic affairs and specifically our democratic process.
That was the tone at the U.S. House of Representatives Wednesday, exemplified respectively in those comments you just heard by Democratic Representative David Ciccolini of Rhode Island, Republican Ed Royce of California, who's also chair of the House Foreign Relations Committee, and his fellow Republican Michael McCaul of Texas, as the House adopted a bill giving Congress the power to block any effort by the White House to weaken sanctions on Russia, and included new sanctions against Russia and Iran and North Korea as well. The bill passed by an overwhelming margin of 419-3, with the three no votes all coming from Republicans, Justin Amash of Michigan, Tom Massey of Kentucky, and John Duncan of Tennessee. The sanctions legislation now moves to the Senate, and Reuters reported on Thursday that U.S. lawmakers reached an agreement that could see passage of the bill as soon as this week. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
One part of the bill that was specifically singled out was the energy sector of Russia's economy. The bill penalizes any company that cooperates with Russia's pipeline projects. This is what Tim Ryan, a representative from Ohio, had to say.
We must continue to focus on how we get our gas here in the United States, our natural gas to Europe, to our allies, so they're not so dependent on Russia.
It seems like things may not be as complicated as they appear. Now, at this point, the new sanctions bill from the U.S. Congress specifically targets the construction of a key Russian gas pipeline into Europe. Now, it says this gas pipeline has a detrimental impact on Europe's energy security. In the same paragraph of the bill, it says that the U.S. should prioritize exporting its own natural gas in order to create American jobs, help its allies, and secure U.S. foreign policy. So is everyone happy about it? Well, absolutely not. The European Commission is planning out what its response will be if European businesses are hurt by the new sanctions from the United States.
We are following this process with some concern regarding the European Union's energy independence and our energy security interests.
Now, at this point, Russia sells the European Union 38% of its natural gas, with only 2% of European Union natural gas imports coming from the United States. You can bet that some slick Wall Street syndicates would like to reverse that lineup. Caleb Maupin, RT, New York.
Aside from the apparent economic motivations for increased sanctions by the U.S. against Russia, there is also the geopolitical situation, which has been developing for the past 4 years at a minimum. For more on that, we spoke with Sputnik News editor Dmitry Babich from his office in Moscow via Skype Thursday.
You know, the danger of these sanctions is not just the limitation on economic exchange and scientific exchange between Russia and the United States. The danger is that the law also presupposes that the United States would provide surveillance. I mean, the president will make reports to the Congress about the Russian businessmen, their connection to the Kremlin, companies that they own inside Russia and abroad, you know, all the property of their spouses, children, parents. It is unprecedented because humanity doesn't know a precedent when the whole elite of a certain country would be under surveillance by a foreign power. Basically, businessmen in Russia, they can be penalized now by the United States simply for having a connection to the Kremlin, which is the center of state power in Russia. Well, I mean, if you tell me that anywhere in the world big business is not connected to the state, I won't believe you. We know that Halliburton has a friend or two in the White House. In Germany, the big media companies, there were whole investigations by the German press on their connections to the federal government. So it's simply hypocritical to say that we're going to, to clean Russia, we're going from outside to improve the corruption climate in Russia, we're going to go after all the businessmen who have wrong connections to the Kremlin. First, it's not up to the United States to decide which connections to the Kremlin are right and which are wrong. And second, it may have an adverse effect because now feeling threatened by the United States, the businessmen, the Russian businessmen, even very loyal to the West, even pro-Western, they may return their money to Russia simply to be on the safe side because if some idiot like Victoria Nuland decides who of them has the right connection to the Kremlin and who of them has the wrong connection, and if that idiot Victoria Nuland or someone like her can confiscate or freeze their property abroad, then they may feel threatened and they may decide to move their money back to Russia, even if they don't like particularly the Russian government. It is simply safer and more predictable to stay with that government instead of talking to someone who doesn't understand you, like Victoria Nuland.
You know, there's some really interesting contradictions here, too. For decades now, we have heard, with respect to China even, and also with Russia, and other former Warsaw Pact countries in particular, that one of the problems with the economic development, this was cited in the 1990s, was the absence of what they called the rule of law, that is, the absence of courts that were predictable according to the standards of, say, Western law firms. And in addition to that, and now we see a condition basically where people who invest or do business with the West are subject to political whims and whimsy like this that makes it, honestly, a very, unpredictable proposition for investment. It creates a very difficult climate for investment. In addition to that, one assumes that driving this hostility towards Russia and also its Iran and North Korea and, you could say, by implication of North Korea and Iran, China. One assumes that the reason for this is the rise of China's economy, the rise of an assertive foreign policy on behalf of Russia, an independent course, and the threat to the hegemony of the ruling elite of the West that this represents. And their own military planning, even now, it's been leaked, is contemplating the rise of, this multipolar world. And we've seen where the attempt to isolate Russia ended up within months with Russia and China declaring a strategic partnership. In other words, the exact opposite impact that they intended by trying to isolate Russia. And I'm wondering if they're not doubling down the way they are going to find, a similar result, that they're essentially helping to uplift a rising Eurasian Union.
Well, now we understand that most of the accusations from the Western companies and from the Western governments that somehow the Russian or the Polish or the Romanian legal frameworks were not good enough and that, we should take lessons from the West on legality. I think, these things were simply shattered by the so-called color revolutions in the former Soviet Union.
Yeah.
I mean, Mikhail Saakashvili, when he came to power in Georgia, as a result of a coup, that was bloodless, but it was still a coup. When he came to power in 2003, what did he do with the relatives of the previous president, Eduard Shevardnadze, a friend of the West, by the way? He took one of them, the richest one, put him in jail and said, I'm going to let you out when a certain amount of money is going to end up on the bank account of the Georgian Treasury. Freedom for money. I let you go, you give me the money. So that was blackmail. That was a real thuggish style of behavior.
Right.
But it wasn't criticized in any way by George Bush, the junior, who was in power then in the United States. Quite on the contrary, George Bush, the junior, visited Georgia in a few months. There was a street in Tbilisi named after George Bush. He praised Saakashvili as the beacon of democracy. So having seen that, I think very few people in Russia or even in Ukraine have doubts as to, you know, the impartiality of Western justice or the high standard of legality in the modern West. We see how somehow, you know, sovereign states are attacked, sometimes not even by military organizations, by individual NATO members. I mean, formerly, Libya was initially bombed in 2011 by a single country, by France. And no one said that Mr. Sarkozy should go to jail because of that. No one particularly bugged Mr. Sarkozy with his personal meetings with Gaddafi, with the fact that he actually hosted Gaddafi in his presidential palace just a few months before bombing Libya and trying to kill Gaddafi. So there is a mafia-style behavior from the side of the Western governments, quite obviously. And all their talk about legality is just empty words after certain things that we have seen lately. Why are they doing that? Why are they pressuring Russia? Well, I think that the reason is not even economic. Because if you look at the costs of the American and European Union's interventions in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in some countries of Europe, such as Yugoslavia, you see that economically it doesn't make any sense. The West is losing money it is still losing money on the whole adventure in Iraq. I mean, if they had left Iraq in peace and continued economic transactions with that country, the coffers of Western companies would get a lot more money.
Right, that's true.
So it's not an economic reason. The reason is this Western utopia, you know, globalist or neoliberal utopia. We just topple all their own governments. We put in place our loyalists, and everyone will be better off. That is the message from the West. That is the reason why they make all these so-called revolutions. In that sense, if you have such a plan, then quite naturally, Russia and China become adversaries, because they are two big countries left, two big sovereign countries, which have their interests, which are not afraid to proclaim their interests, which are not afraid of competition. You know, China is not afraid of economic competition. Russia is not afraid of military competition. So in this situation, Russia and China become enemies by definition. And that's why you have this pathetic situation when everyone saw how Barack Obama intervened in the American election. He meddled, quite literally, you know, promising the G7 members that Donald Trump, the opposition candidate, would never be elected the president of the United States.
Right.
Yeah, Obama was absolutely not acting within his powers when he made that statement. We saw how the press was terribly biased during the election in the United States. And these are not, you know, these things are not seen as problems by the media and by the Congress now. What is a problem? The fact that a Russian lawyer came to the United States a year ago and she met with the son-in-law of the of one of the presidential candidates. And, oh my God, she discussed with him Hillary Clinton. And she even said that Hillary could be involved in something bad. Well, I mean, this is just pathetic. And on the ground of this, they're going to slap sanctions on Russia, putting Russia in the same, in the same bucket with two very different countries, such as Iran and North Korea. All the congressmen, with the exception of two, I think this is the moment when even the liberal Russians are stopping to believe in the American pluralism.
Yeah, there's no evidence of any pluralism at all in Congress on this particular point. And, what's interesting to me and what's frightening to me also is the fact that they have Russia at the heart of both this and at the heart of the attack on President Trump. That the offensive thing, you know, the same people that are in the streets calling themselves anti-fascists find that their problem with Trump is that he would like to loosen the hostility regime towards Russia and try to work together with Russia to make peace in places like Syria. This, for some reason, is almost a unanimous point of outrage among the U.S. Congress members of both parties, which means essentially that there is a huge chunk, one whole branch of the U.S. government that has hostility towards the other nuclear power in the world as an organizing principle. That's a frightening thought.
If you look at what the Congress is doing right now, it is trying to create a lot of friction points with Russia, and it is removing the old safety belts, you know, the old checks and balances that would prevent the conflict from flaring up. I mean, in the Baltics, where the United States and the EU say they face, you know, a perspective of a Russian aggression, they put their German troops, British troops, French troops, right on the border with Russia, right next to St. Petersburg, in the places like Estonia or Latvia. Well, if indeed something happens, even though Russia never, I repeat, never contemplated, you know, the option of invading these countries, but even if there is a border incident and just one of the Western soldiers gets hurt, someone from Britain or from Germany, it was pronounced officially by NATO's commanders that that would be seen as an attack against that country. So in this way, they don't leave any room for maneuver. I mean, if there is a border incident, that is an attack on the country like Germany or Britain, and then all the other NATO countries get involved with their nuclear weapons and heaven knows what else. Now, the Congress is basically stripping Donald Trump, the president, of his powers to stop or to put on hold the sanctions against Russia. So the Congress is doing everything to make a conflict, to make a showdown inevitable. It is removing the barriers, you know, the safety nets. So the world now is looking more and more like an acrobat, you know, walking a tightrope with Western countries carefully removing all the safety nets that they had placed under that very acrobat in the times of Nixon, in the times of even in the 60s, you know, when basically the arms control process started originally. Now there are almost no limitations on the Western military presence in Eastern Europe. Russia, of course, in this situation is not going just to stay and watch. I mean, it is going to have its military presence on its own territory. The West is applying just slapping sanctions wherever there is a problem. It, you know, the EU even contemplated slapping sanctions on its members, Poland and Hungary. So this is really a very dangerous, very explosive situation. But as I told you, you know, the problem is that in this way, the Congress is strengthening its own opponents abroad. I mean, now even the liberally minded Russians do not say that the U.S. Congress is such a pluralistic place, you know, with all opinions expressed and with people like pulling the United States in different directions depending on their convictions. We see that it is a very well media controlled, you know, collection of characters. Some of them very aggressive, like John McCain. None of them ever having or ever feeling any repentance for the crimes which they acknowledged America had done. You know, like the Congress and them, even the mainstream media, they all agreed that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake, as they say, even though a mistake in which people die, it's usually called a crime. But nevertheless, they behave as if that never happened, as if the invasion of Iraq never happened. You know, they accuse the Russian media of whataboutism, like the United States criticizes Russia for introducing legislation on foreign agents. And when Russia says, well, the biggest scandal that you are having right now is about people whom you call foreign agents, you know, simply right. because they had any relation to Russia.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if we were accused of whataboutism, you know, saying what about your foreign agents? Now I think we can accuse the American mass media and the academia of what I would call let's move onism. Like we say, okay, just remember what you did to Iraq. Forget about Iraq. Let's move on. But look, I mean, you yourself acknowledge that, you know, your regime change in Libya was obviously not very successful. You agree that there is a civil war going on there. Yes, there is a civil war going on there. We destroyed a few things there, but let's move on. Let's move on. You know, let's move on is very, very dangerous because it leads to impunity. I mean, you can destroy Iraq, you can destroy Libya, you can create a civil war in Ukraine, and whenever you will be criticized for that, you will say, okay, let's move on. We have another country on our plate right now. Right?
You have coming up in March, the 100th anniversary of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, you know, the stripping away at that time by Germany and really the U.S. and the U.K. and France of the parts of Russia that, again, have been stripped away. These are the Baltics, which were part of the Russian Empire up until 1918, Ukraine, including Crimea, and also at that time they took Belarus away, which is, you know, again an independent state, as you mentioned, they have also stripped away the safeguards that have been put into place since the time of the red phones installed after the Cuban Missile Crisis and the various treaties, the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which has been renounced by the United States, etc. We've had speaking of the rule of law, this coup d'etat with the United States throwing in with one group of Ukrainian oligarchs against the elected government there. Accidents do happen, if you want to call it an accident, when a NATO country, Turkey, shoots down a Russian plane over a third-party country illegally. These risks do exist, and the framework for protecting against, you know, negative outcomes has been dismantled with yesterday's congressional action, yet another stone in that wall.
Well, you are right. Talking about the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, I think it was a separate story. It was a Russian-German agreement. Yes. Basically, the Bolsheviks were giving up a huge chunk of Russian territory. It was the price for stepping out of war with Germany. And of course, the Bolsheviks did not view this treaty as sacrosanct. They were expecting a world revolution. I think Leo Trotsky was very disappointed when it didn't happen in the next 3 years. But the way the Bolsheviks behaved in 1918 when they prepared for the treaty was indeed awful, because if you look at the map, they gave up Crimea. Crimea was supposed to become German. You probably might know that Hitler actually wanted to populate Crimea by Germans after winning the war with the Soviet Union. Why? Because the Gothic tribes actually came to Europe from Crimea. They were pushed out of Crimea by the advancing Huns back in the 3rd century AD. So Crimea was supposed to be in the German zone of influence as a result of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty. And that treaty became one of the reasons for the civil war in Russia, because suddenly, you know, even the few allies that Bolsheviks had, like the Social Democrats, the true Social Democrats, you know, the Mensheviks and the others, they saw that Bolsheviks were completely unpatriotic, at least it seemed so. They were prepared to sacrifice Russia for the world revolution, and that led to a rift between the Bolsheviks and the other socialist factions. What's going on now is connected to this story, but indirectly. I mean, it's just amazing how partial and cruel the West can be in everything that relates to Russia's relations with Ukraine. Like yesterday, the Ukrainian authorities declared that they were suspending all electricity supplies to the Donetsk region. And just for your information, Donetsk region, that is now 2.3 million people, you know, the area controlled by the rebels. Lugansk, you know, a neighboring rebel region with 1.5 million of population, it has been switched off from Ukrainian electricity back in April this year. Wow. So that's a huge event. I mean, in Europe, it would be a huge event and a very cruel one. Imagine 2 million people without electricity. And the German media does not pay any attention to it. Mm. What interests German media? Two turbines, you know, two turbines made with the help of Siemens technology in Russia were illegally brought to Crimea in breach of economic sanctions imposed by the European community. How awful, you know, 2 million Crimeans will be warmed and they will get light from the turbines made on the basis of a German technology. Punish Russia for that, you know. Break off the relations. Stop all the contracts of Siemens in Russia. No one pays attention to the fact that Ukraine is not giving electricity to millions of its own citizens, you know, who simply do not want to agree to the new regime that came to power as a result of a coup in Kiev. That is not important. What is important is that Crimeans may be warmed and they may have light from some equipment used, you know, produced with German help. So it just shows you how partial and cruel that system can be. It claims that it is humanistic, that it is democratic, that it is for everyone. In reality, it is very narrow-minded, very vindictive, and sometimes very cruel. And, I mean, I hate when people in Russia and in other countries, when they say, oh, the modern regime in the United States is fascist, you know, or in the EU they are hidden fascists. No, they are not fascists. They are new. They have a new kind of totalitarianism. You may call it globalist totalitarianism or neoliberal totalitarianism. The problem is that this new totalitarianism is ready to make alliances with fascists. In Ukraine, this is an alliance with the radical Ukrainian nationalists who were even more cruel than Nazis during the World War II, even more cruel than Nazis to the Poles, to the Jews, to the Ukrainians who didn't agree with them. In Syria, this globalist US-EU imperialism, they ally themselves to the Sunni radical Islamists, you know. Again, people capable of immense cruelty. All of that doesn't mean that, you know, the people who order it in Washington or in Brussels, that they won't sit with a person speaking Russian, or that they actually approve of Shia Muslims or Alawites being killed by the Sunni Muslims. No, but Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Obama before her, they were prepared to see that happen. They were prepared to support the killing of Russians in Ukraine or the killing of Alawites in Syria. Because, as it seemed to them, it was bringing their utopia closer. It was making the establishment of the neoliberal order in the world closer to reality.
And that's what matters to them. Dmitry, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you. I hope I was entertaining.
As always.
Thanks for getting me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.